This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to the Massachusetts State House News Service, providing our listeners with high-quality, comprehensive, objective information about the activities of our state government. Today, we are covering the week of July 6th through 12th, 2026. This program is sponsored by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. This is Paula Simchak. Ann Manning Martin, a Republican candidate for lieutenant governor, cannot appear on September's primary ballot under a split decision issued by an Essex County Superior Court judge Friday. Republican candidate for lieutenant governor Sean Oliver and Democratic Party Executive Director Adam Roof filed similar complaints with the State Ballot Law Commission, alleging Manning Martin had filed fraudulent nomination signatures and didn't get the necessary 10,000 certified signatures to appear on the ballot. The complaints were considered as one, and on June 26, the commission sustained their challenges to 1,279 of the 10,692 nomination signatures Manning Martin submitted. On Friday, Associate Justice Jeffrey Karp addressed Roof and Oliver's motions to scrub Manning Martin from the ballot separately. Karp overruled the commission's decision on Roof's complaint and upheld the commission's ruling on Oliver's objection. Karp ruled that the commission's decision to bar Manning Martin's name from appearing on September's primary ballot was affirmed. In a three-page order, Karp said he plans to issue a formal memorandum on July 13th explaining his reasoning. Karp said the decision to overturn the commission's ruling on Roof's complaint stemmed from his failure to comply with the requirement to send the objection via certified mail, similar to Karp's reasoning in the ruling to restore Republican Attorney General candidate Michael Walsh's name on the ballot. Karp found Oliver complied with the mailing requirements and said the commission's decision to invalidate Manning Martin's signatures was supported by substantial evidence. Manning Martin did not immediately respond to the News Service's request for comment on the ruling. Oliver and his gubernatorial counterpart, Brian Shortsleeve, celebrated the ruling. Election integrity is essential to confidence in our democracy. The court's decision today reconfirms that submitting fraudulent signatures to illegitimately obtain ballot access is a gross violation of the law and compromises the integrity of our elections, Oliver and Shortsleeve said in a joint statement provided at the request of the News Service. Amy Carnival, chairwoman of the Mass GOP, said the party is thrilled that justice prevailed today for Walsh and was disappointed by the ruling on Manning Martin's case. Voters deserve contested races, real choices, and confidence that election laws will be applied fairly and consistently, Carnival said, adding the party plans to monitor for appeals in both cases. Manning Martin can still appeal the decision, but time is running out. According to court documents, official ballots must be finalized by July 14. Also, under federal law, Secretary of State William Galvin's office is facing a July 18 deadline to issue ballots. Republican Attorney General hopeful Michael Walsh can appear on September's primary ballot under an Essex County Superior Court judge's ruling issued Friday. The decision, which came from Associate Justice Jeffrey Karp, overrules a State Ballot Law Commission decision to scrub Walsh's name from the ballot over his submission of allegedly fraudulent nomination signatures. In the ruling, Karp said that despite substantial evidence in the record of fraud or fraud, the commission lacked jurisdiction to consider the complaint from Massachusetts Democratic Party Executive Director Adam Roof, alleging that Walsh had submitted fraudulent nomination signatures and did not have the required 10,000 certified signatures to get on the ballot. Early on in the case, Walsh moved to dismiss Roof's complaint, saying he failed to meet the requirement to serve the objection via certified mail. In his decision, the commission denied Walsh's motion, finding that failure to meet the requirements didn't hinder Walsh because he still received the objection. Karp disagreed. It is this court's view that the SBLC's reasoning is misplaced and that the SBLC erred as a matter of law by failing to dismiss the objection, Karp said in the 14-page ruling. Walsh celebrated the ruling and criticized both the Democratic Party's complaint and the commission's decision to strike his name from the ballot. Elections are decided at the ballot box, not by politicians and appointed bureaucrats. They lost. The voters won. And now we have an election to win, Walsh said in a statement. The commission plans to appeal the decision to the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, according to a spokesperson for Mass Dems. Time is running out to get the ballots ready in time for the September 1 primary. Under federal law, Secretary of State William Galvin must issue primary ballots for this year's election by July 18. Senate leaders on Thursday teed up legislation to mitigate pervasive violence against healthcare workers, though perpetrators could face a lesser criminal charge compared to the version that cleared the House in the fall. People who assault healthcare workers, including at hospitals and doctor's offices, could be charged with misdemeanor offenses under legislation the Senate Ways and Means Committee advanced Thursday morning. Assaults would be classified as a felony under the version the House unanimously passed November 19th. The Massachusetts Health and Hospital Association estimates that every 38 minutes, someone in a healthcare facility, most likely a clinician or employee, is physically assaulted, verbally abused, or threatened. Violence prevention bills have faltered on Beacon Hill for years, but this session's proposals include buy-in across the Massachusetts Nurses Association, MHA, and the Massachusetts Division of 1199 SEIU United Healthcare Workers East. Thursday's traction in the Senate comes amid a historic work stoppage at Brigham and Women's Hospital after more than 4,000 nurses went on strike Wednesday. MNA President Katie Murphy had to clear her throat before she spoke at a Thursday morning press conference in the Senate reading room, saying she'd come straight from the picket line. "It's such an important day and another step closer to safer working conditions in our state's health care facilities," Murphy said. "It also shows what we can accomplish when parts come together with the best interests of health care workers and patients in mind." On the enforcement front, bill sponsor Senator Joan Lovely said the Senate diverged from the House after listening to feedback from behavioral health and disability advocates. She used an example of a patient showing up at the emergency department with a psychiatric issue and not going in as themselves when an assault occurs. "We wanted to take a different approach to the House than the House that would automatically, you know, an assault on a healthcare worker would be a felony," Lovely said. "We wanted to take that and look at a misdemeanor." The Senate will vote on the legislation next Thursday alongside a home care licensure bill. The House passed its home care oversight bill on a 153-1 vote November 5th. Under the House Healthcare Workplace Violence Prevention Bill, an assault resulting in serious bodily injury could trigger a combination of imprisonment and fines, with the maximum penalties entailing 10 years in prison and a $5,000 fine. A misdemeanor under the Senate Ways and Means Bill could lead up to 2.5 years in a house of correction with no financial penalty, according to Middlesex District Attorney Marion Ryan. "The important piece of this is that it makes that misdemeanor now have a right of arrest. Typically, misdemeanors don't ever, in any circumstance, have a right of arrest," Ryan told the news service, adding that protection extends to healthcare workers whose assaults go unwitnessed. Misdemeanors could include kicking or punching healthcare workers without inflicting serious injuries, Ryan said. But the DA said the Senate language would not prevent prosecutors from pursuing felony charges in more violent attacks. "For instance, if somebody were to assault somebody with a weapon, all right, that would be a felony. Somebody were to assault somebody and cause a certain level of injuries, that would still be a felony. So this bill doesn't change any of that," Ryan said. "For instance, somebody attacks a healthcare worker and there's a terrible strangulation or something so dangerous that that might be an assault with intent to murder. That's a felony." The legislation requires healthcare employers to conduct annual facility risk assessments, develop workplace violence prevention programs, and annually report incidents to the Department of Public Health. It also bolsters law enforcement's ability to make a prompt arrest when workers experience assault and battery, according to a Senate summary. Employers must offer paid leave for healthcare workers who are assaulted on the job. The leave would cover their time seeking medical treatment for injuries or aiding in the prosecution of their attacker, according to the Senate summary. In another layer of privacy, workers can list their employer's or labor union's address on a criminal complaint rather than their home address. The Senate Ways and Means Committee also advanced legislation to establish a licensing framework for home care workers who assist with daily activities like meal preparation, dressing, and bathing. The state's rapidly aging population has led to ballooning demand for home care workers who enable older adults to maintain their independence and live in their communities. The Executive Office of Health and Human Services would be required to post an online list of licensed home care agencies under the Senate Ways and Means Bill. It also creates the Home Care Worker and Consumer Abuse Stakeholder Advisory Committee, tasked with helping EOHHS develop regulations around safety concerns for home care patients and workers. Proposed licensure would ensure peace of mind for families, safety for people receiving care, and a high level of integrity for all home care workers, according to a Senate fact sheet. The House took baby steps towards addressing double utility poles that have frustrated municipal leaders for years. On Wednesday, representatives embedded language within an amendment to a sweeping economic development bill that creates a permanent working group to serve as an informational resource, eyes improvements to a utility pole database, and seeks solutions to resolve communication problems among parties involved with the poles. The issues arise when a utility pole needs to be replaced. Utility companies often install a new pole next to an old one. Then the utility company transfers everything from the old pole to the new one. State law requires old poles to be removed within 90 days, but they often stay put. Municipal leaders say the double poles create unnecessary obstacles for drivers and pedestrians and lead to situations where high-voltage wires could be attached to poles that are not set in the ground. Utilities have said efforts to remove the pole don't consider the amount of coordination needed when different companies have equipment on the same pole. The policy representatives passed also gets rid of the 90-day deadline and is a revised version of an idea Governor Maura Healey included in her so-called Municipal Empowerment Act. That would double the time utilities have to remove poles to 180 days, but also grant municipalities authority to enforce the deadline with $1,000 penalties. The new working group would be tasked, under the House language, with developing an incentive and accountability structure within 6 months. On Tuesday, the Massachusetts Municipal Association, which would have a spot in the working group, sent a letter to lawmakers urging them to pass Healey's municipal empowerment legislation. The legislature divided that bill into multiple pieces, some of which have been scuttled. MMA Legislative Director Dave Kaufman said the proposal the House added to the Economic Development Bill marks a good step forward. It's a great progress. I think we also continue to know that we're looking for progress in any means necessary, he said. Kaufman said there's a fair conversation to be had on what the right timeline for double pole removal should look like, and that all ideas that are actually going to compel action, including different fines, should be considered. On the eve of Foxborough's final FIFA World Cup showing, representatives included $1 million within their $561 million economic development bill to reimburse businesses within the clean zones created at Gillette Stadium for the matches. FIFA's clean zone policy restricts commercial activity and requires World Cup venues to get rid of branding not related to its sponsors. The policy is behind why Gillette Stadium was renamed to Boston Stadium for World Cup games, and why logos and ads representing any companies aside from official FIFA sponsors have been covered from the outset of the series. The House policy language would bestow a cumulative $1 million on impacted businesses for loss of revenue during World Cup games held in June and July. The policy was part of the nearly $136 million in earmarks added to the bill's bottom line Wednesday evening. Official FIFA World Cup 2026 sponsors include Coca-Cola, Adidas, and Visa, among others. As NPR reported recently, however, in some cases, the act of covering up logos has brought even more attention to the brands typically shown off at host stadiums like Gillette in Foxborough or Levi's Stadium outside San Francisco. Thursday's quarterfinal match between Morocco and France is the seventh of the tournament in Massachusetts. The state in the spring was anticipating over 2 million visitors, the creation of 7,000 jobs, more than $70 million in tax revenue, and $1 billion in economic output as a result of the matches, according to Boston 2026 estimates. The state secured $76 million in federal money for World Cup security and preparedness, and the Healey administration in March gave $10 million worth of grants for fan celebrations and community watch parties across the state. The House's reimbursement policy will have to survive the Senate's version of the Economic Development Bill, which Senate President Karen Spilka said Thursday the chamber is already working on. Two losing bidders sued the state and the winning developer Thursday to block Springfield's new regional courthouse project. USPV JV LLC, led by James E. Jeb Belice, and Springfield Tower Square LLC, led by Dinesh Patel, filed a verified complaint in Hampden County Superior Court against the Massachusetts Division of Capital Asset Management and Maintenance and FDSMA Liberty Junction LLC, the entity associated with the winning proposal. The developers are seeking to halt the state's planned 40-year lease for the Springfield Regional Justice Center until a judge reviews their claims that the procurement violated state law and the project's request for proposals. The lawsuit challenges DCAMM's provisional selection of Liberty Junction, a team that includes FD Stonewater, Kojo Partners, and Suffolk Construction. Kojo Partners counts Massachusetts Convention Center Authority Interim Executive Director John Barros and Conan Harris, the husband of U.S. Representative Ayanna Pressley, among its principals. The complaint alleges the award is rife with conflicts of interest, pointing out that Barros became interim executive director of the MCCA in January, a powerful state agency whose board of directors includes senior DCAMM officials, while DCAMM was still evaluating proposals. It also alleges the winning proposal also failed to comply with multiple requirements in the request for proposals. According to the complaint, the Liberty Junction proposal failed to comply with the RFP in numerous material respects, including failure to comply with leasing requirements and containing inconsistencies on tax treatment. The plaintiffs are asking the court to declare that DCAMM violated the conflict of interest law and materially breached its procurement, set aside the provisional award, or void any executed lease, and issue an injunction preventing the state from moving forward with the project while the case is pending. This is not an effort to stop Springfield from getting a new courthouse. It is an effort to prevent the Commonwealth from locking taxpayers into a 40-year lease before serious questions about the award are reviewed, Belise said in a statement. DCAMM announced July 2nd that Liberty Junction had been provisionally selected to redevelop 125 Liberty Street into the future Springfield Regional Justice Center under a long-term lease. State officials said the proposal offered the best overall value, citing its lower projected cost, accelerated delivery schedule, and downtown location. Burroughs did not respond to a request for comment when the award was announced. DCAMM said it would not comment on ongoing litigation. A ballot initiative proposing to repeal adult-use recreational marijuana is facing another challenge to the authenticity of its nomination signatures. On Wednesday, Kevin Gilnack filed an objection with Secretary of State William Galvin's office disputing the validity of signatures filed in support of the ballot question. In the 7-page objection, Gilnack said numerous signatures were obtained through fraudulent means and were not genuine. Also, Gilnack said there were signatures from voters who had later requested their names be removed from the petitions. As a result, Gilnack contends, the committee backing the ballot question did not file the necessary 12,429 certified signatures to secure a spot on November's ballot. That marked the final batch of signatures petitioners had to collect after a panel of lawmakers decided that none of the initiative petitions brought before them this year warranted legislative attention. Earlier this year, the initiative petition survived other objections to its nomination signatures, and in June, the Supreme Judicial Court ruled that the initiative petition could move forward onto the ballot after opponents argued that Attorney General Andrea Campbell's summary of the proposal was not fair. Wendy Wakeman, chair of the ballot committee backing the ballot proposal, stood behind the signatures when asked about the latest challenge. "This is one last desperate attempt to keep our question off the ballot," Wakeman told the news service, adding she and other proponents stand by the signatures. The State Ballot Law Commission plans to hold hearings on the objection beginning July 15. If needed, hearings will continue on July 16 and July 17. After getting cut out of the legislature's last major housing bill, the so-called Tenant Opportunity to Purchase Act found new life in the House's policy-dense $561 million economic development bill. On Wednesday night, representatives quietly adopted a mega-amendment that included a local option version of the policy, which is often referred to as Tenant Right of First Refusal and known by the acronym TOPA. It requires multifamily property owners to notify their tenant and city or town when they decide to sell the property. Then, tenants would have the right to make the first offer to buy the property. The idea has had a rocky past on Beacon Hill. In 2021, then-Governor Charlie Baker vetoed the policy from an economic development bill, and in 2024, the House added TOPA provisions to its own version of a major housing legislation, but the policy didn't make its way into the final version of the bill. Opponents to the measure include landlords, developers, and property owners who say it could create barriers for transactions and deter housing investors. A tenant right of first refusal, ROFR, would cause serious delays and impediments to the normal conveyance process in the Commonwealth. This works against efforts to address the housing crisis by eliminating the ability to finance, develop, and operate rental housing, which reduces available rental housing supply. The Greater Boston Real Estate Board said in a November letter opposing several bills, including those dealing with the right of first refusal, to the Committee on Housing. Supporters say the policy helps sustain affordable housing, prevents resident displacement, and provides an avenue to home ownership for renters, which creates more opportunities to build wealth. TOPA is an essential component to fighting the resident displacement and speculative purchases brought on by the pandemic-spurred housing market turmoil by preserving naturally occurring affordable housing, NOAH. Cassie White, Director of Policy and Community Organizing, said in a November letter to the Housing Committee in support of bills establishing the right of first refusal. This legislation will not only help cities and towns to face the housing crisis, but prevent further housing loss by vulnerable tenants. Both bills mentioned in the letters are sitting in front of their respective chambers' Committee on Ways and Means. The House's economic development bill now heads for the Senate, and no other major housing legislation has emerged this session as residents are facing soaring home prices. Lawmakers have until July 31 to either pass major legislation or get bills into a six-person conference committee. A small business industry group is calling out representatives for quietly tucking in a new mandatory retirement program into the $561 million economic development bill the House passed on Wednesday. Among the slew of policies representatives added to the bill was the creation of a Secure Choice Savings Program that's meant to boost retirement savings for employees. It's similar to an outside section Governor Maura Healey vetoed in the legislature's proposed fiscal year 2026 budget. The National Federation of Independent Business has been staunchly opposed to the policy, and the group criticized representatives for attaching it to the economic development bill. Passing a new mandate on employers runs counter to lawmakers' narrative regarding making Massachusetts a more affordable and competitive state to conduct business, Christopher Carlozzi, state director of NFIB, said in a statement. Under the program, employers with 25 or more employees who have been in business for at least 2 years and do not already offer a qualified retirement plan, such as a 401k, must automatically enroll participating employees in the retirement savings plan and remit payroll deductions from the workers. Employers are responsible for enrolling employees and could face penalties starting at $250 per employee per year if they fail to do so. This Secure Choice Savings Program not only affects employers, but will require workers to affirmatively opt out if they do not want money deducted from their paychecks. NFIB supports efforts to identify barriers to retirement savings, especially given the prevalence of low-cost savings options already available in the marketplace, Carlozzi added. However, we continue to oppose another payroll mandate on employers forcing them to manage and administer a new state-run program or face hefty fines and lawsuits. Representatives attached the provision to the bill through a consolidated amendment that the House adopted with no floor discussion. Supporters of the idea have noted that it can help workers at smaller businesses who don't have access to other savings plans. In 2025, 56% of workers participated in a workplace retirement plan, according to the Pension Rights Center, which cited the 2025 Bureau of Labor Statistics National Compensation Survey. Employees can select their contribution levels and opt out of the program. Employers can also offer alternative retirement plans like a 401k, a defined benefit plan, a simplified employee pension plan, or a savings incentive match plan for employees. Without so much as a speech, representatives on Wednesday evening signed off on creating a 5-year psychedelics pilot program that would allow for the monitored mental health care of clinically appropriate patients using naturally occurring psychedelic materials in a supervised licensed mental health clinic setting. Pilot program permits would be issued to up to 3 licensed mental health clinic facilities for the purposes of establishing the best and safest clinical practices for psychedelic mental health treatment programs in the Commonwealth, and for the purposes of collecting patient outcomes data regarding the benefits of psychedelic pharmacotherapy. The measure was tucked into a large policy-backed amendment to the House's economic development package. The amendment passed unanimously at 8:55 p.m., and the bill passed 148-2. Exploring psychedelic usage isn't a new concept in Massachusetts. Voters in 2024 rejected a ballot question that would have legalized the personal and clinical use of some natural psychedelics like psilocybin. While opponents said the substances could have unintended health risks, supporters pointed to research showing that natural psychedelics can help treat some mental health conditions, like PTSD and depression, as well as addiction. Some representatives indicated in early 2025 that they wanted to restart the debate on the substances. The organizations tapped for the House proposed pilot program could not be subsidiaries, affiliates, or members of cannabis industry organizations, psychedelic molecule development companies, or pharmaceutical companies. Organizations would have to track patient care outcomes data related to the identification, diagnosis, and psychedelic treatment of depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, and substance use disorder, according to bill language. The data would be shared with the Department of Public Health to assist in the refinement of best clinical protocols and final regulatory frameworks for the safe use of psychedelic material in the Commonwealth. The measure would create a medical psychedelics fund to support the pilot. DPH would have to create rules and regulations about the process of patient assessment, the role of program oversight, and more, and would coordinate with research institutions to facilitate, expand, and expedite federally authorized research on psychedelic-assisted therapies. The House policy will have to survive in the Senate, which will likely in the coming weeks redraft and pass its own version of the massive economic development bill. After disposing of nearly 700 amendments and adding about $136 million to the bottom line, the House passed a $561 million policy-heavy catch-all economic development bill Wednesday night. An economic development bill the legislature generally takes up every other July tends to become a vehicle for representatives' end-of-session priorities that they haven't been able to move into another piece of legislation. And representatives had 688 priorities they wanted to add to this session's bill, all of which were withdrawn or handled within five consolidated amendments the House adopted with little floor discussion. Among the policies embedded within the mega amendments were authorization for municipal policies granting tenants of multifamily buildings the right to first refusal when their property is up for sale, a gambling expansion to allow simulcast centers to take bets on historical horse races on electronic terminals that casinos say are essentially slot machines and via smartphones, a requirement that motion pictures getting state tax credits include a credit and logo stating it was made in Massachusetts, a tax credit for digital game development companies, a pilot program to allow some uses of psychedelic substances, a new commission to assess ways to resolve conflicts that arise from double utility poles, a system for issuing electronic IDs, and a grant program focused on recruiting and retaining master's-level social work students from historically marginalized and low-income communities. The nearly $136 million in earmarks representatives added included $1 million for businesses in Gillette Stadium designated clean zones that were created for the FIFA World Cup. FIFA has a clean zone policy restricting commercial activity and requiring venues to get rid of branding not related to its sponsors. Other notable funding representatives added included $1.5 million for Worcester to redevelop the Worcester Memorial Auditorium into an artificial intelligence innovation center and entertainment facility, and a new $500,000 line item for a grant program for employers to help current or former workers who were authorized under the Federal Temporary Protected Status Program. That line item comes weeks after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that President Donald Trump can roll back TPS status for Haitian and Syrian immigrants, a move Governor Maura Healey said would be devastating for families and the state's economy. This well-rounded economic development package makes significant targeted investments into major sectors of the Commonwealth's economy. By advancing this legislation, we will be helping our small businesses cope with an ever-changing economic picture while also making key advantages for housing developments and protections across the Commonwealth, House Ways and Means Chair Aaron Mitchellwood said in a statement following the bill's passage. Representatives voted 148-2 to pass the bill, with Republican Representatives Kenneth Sweezy and David DeCoste opposed. The House added a number of housing policies and related bonding into the bill's borrowing capacity, its only response so far this session to the housing crisis that is constantly referred to as one of the state's most pressing issues. The bill includes $120 million for housing-related investments, which Economic Development Committee Chair Carol Fiola said from the floor would support commercial conversion projects, veterans housing, and remediation of former state buildings. She said the bill also codifies the state's site plan review process, allows municipalities to adopt commercial conversion ordinances to turn commercial properties into housing and mixed-use developments, and establishes a framework allowing multifamily housing by right on qualifying land owned by religious institutions. The legislation also includes a new framework governing micromobility devices, establishing safety standards and operating rules for personal transportation devices such as motorized bicycles. House Speaker Ron Mariano said the measure had evolved into a vehicle for addressing a range of outstanding policy issues that did not warrant standalone sessions before the legislature's formal business wraps up. We reach a point where there's a lot of little things going on that don't require a full formal session, but need to be straightened out, Mariano said. You've been listening to an episode of the Massachusetts State House News Service, a program produced by Audio Journal and sponsored by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. This is Paula Simchak. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for more informative programming by Audio Journal.
What's going on in your town is important to you. Meetings that decide your taxes, changes in laws in your community, plans for new housing and businesses, and news about schools are all vital for you to know. Here on Audio Journal, we read many local community newspapers each week. In addition to the news of your community and area, you'll also hear about special events, stories about your neighbors, their businesses, their activities, and more. Stay in touch with your community on Audio Journal, broadcasting to print-impaired residents of central Massachusetts.